I'm Janet Larson, and I teach literature at Rutgers University in New Jersey. I sometimes like to talk about poetry as nonsense, as a form of divine nonsense, poetry in general. And one reason for that is beautifully expressed in a famous passage in the Midsummer Night's Dream, Act 5, Shakespeare's play. You probably have heard this before somewhere. Lovers and madmen have such seething brains, such shaping fantasies that apprehend more than cool reason ever comprehends. The lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact. One sees more devils than vast hell can hold, that is the madman. The lover, all as frantic, sees Helen's beauty in a brow of Egypt. The poet's eye, in a fine frenzy rolling, doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven, and as imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. Have you ever heard that before, anybody? The lover, the lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact. Of course, Shakespeare knew quite a bit about imaginative writing and loving as well. It's a sonneteer. And there's a lot in that quotation to think about, but certainly one is that they are all, what they all have in common is that they are possessed by their imaginations. And interestingly, Shakespeare doesn't really mean to suggest that their imaginations body forth things that are not real. He calls them airy nothings. But he says that their shaping fantasies apprehend more than cool reason ever comprehends. And so imagination is what helps you to understand things that your reason couldn't help you see or appreciate. So it's not a useless kind of imagination. And he says, apprehend more than cool reason ever comprehends. I like that word more. I like it for a number of reasons. We were reading the Song of Songs. You folks want to move up a little bit? Kind of get into this Sunday school class circle we've got going here. Start a second row pretty soon. Thank you. Welcome. This table. We were reading the Song of Songs, and if there's any book of the Bible that is too much, to use the slang expression, that's it. I mean, was anybody here yesterday when we read that? It's just image piled on image, isn't it? And experience after experience. And it seems as though it could go on forever. It really doesn't stop. And it just stops, finally. More and more. As though the quality of love or of erotic poetry, at least, is to keep reaching for more and not to stop. Nonsense is a kind of more than you would ordinarily see in life or experience or that your reason would comprehend. And the other thing about this is that it talks about the imagination. And I like sort of Coleridge's definition of the imagination. You know, Coleridge is an English romantic poet who wrote The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. You all remember that, probably from somewhere in your life. Coleridge said the imagination is a synthetic power. It's that power you have in your mind, and each of us has it. We don't have to be a lunatic or a poet to have it. It's that power which helps you to make connections, to synthesize, to put things together, to leap over obstacles or logical chains of thought and find a connection that you just find. And people have that power, and if we didn't have it, we couldn't survive for very long. So you have to be able to conceive of things you can't see all the time and to make connections. So I guess nonsense is also a kind of poetry that yokes unlike things. For example, heaven and earth. You know, unlike things. So there is something always been associated with religion, with the imagination, partly I think because of its power to apprehend what we can't see, what is more, what is beyond the everyday, the visible, the natural world. And we looked at the Song of Songs as God's nonsense, and in I want to get into some other stuff today, but there was one thing I didn't get to really say very much about yesterday. My ears are stopped up from coming down the mountain too fast, so if I'm talking too loud, I'm sorry. But I was saying something about how the Song of Songs has been interpreted. You know, it's an 8-chapter erotic poem, essentially. And you look at it and you say, this is in the Bible, it can't possibly mean what it appears to mean. It's got to mean more than what it looks to mean. Well, it's presented an immense challenge to interpreters of Scripture who want to interpret Scripture literally. It can't simply be about these two lovers. Must be about more than that. And so there have been all kinds of very fancy explanations of the Song of Songs. But what I find kind of interesting is the way that the Protestant and Catholic traditions of interpretation have varied in looking at this nonsensical book that doesn't seem to fit in the Bible. The fact that it's there seems kind of nonsensical. And then if you read it, there are all kinds of nonsense in the book, things that don't connect, don't make sense. Protestants have looked at it and interpreted it as, you know, both Protestants and Catholics have seen it as being about the love of God and his church or the searching soul or whatever. But they've looked at that a little bit differently. The Protestants have emphasized the metaphor of the marriage, that the emphasis has been on the domestic qualities of marriage. And if the Song of Songs is about spiritual truth, then it's sort of about the spiritual truth behind the marriage. And they use the marriage contract as a metaphor that they've sort of read out of the Song of Songs. In the Catholic tradition, what they see as important in the Song of Songs, in the love poetry there, is the idea of sexual union in one flesh. As a development, really, of the idea in Genesis that we're, you know, Adam, I was talking about this the other day, where Adam breaks out into poetry and greets Eve as bone of my bone, and so on, flesh of my flesh. But in the Catholic tradition, what it finds important about the relationship between this text and some kind of spiritual interpretation is the quality in sexual union of total self-abandonment, which is a posture towards God that is sort of the pinnacle of human spiritual experience. And it's the irrationality of the book that they celebrate, not its faithfulness, mutual affection, and those qualities that Protestants find, you know, more manageable and recognizable in marriage. And I just want to read you something that's very un-Protestant from Bernard of Clairvaux, who has written a famous commentary on Song of Songs. I've not read it, but I have read about it. And this is a little introduction to this. I'm going to read you a short bit from one of his sermons and an introduction to that. He says, "In the highest reaches of divine love, all considerations of prudence, order, and decorum, all the rules of etiquette and rhetoric are transcended. Again, it is for that reason that divine love is most aptly symbolized not by friendship or familial love or domestic affection, but by obliterating drunkenness and sexual passion. In short, it is in the nature of sexual passion to transcend all other considerations." And it's that idea that's clearly there in the Song of Songs that then the allegorists build on talk about the relationship between soul and God. And this is what Bernard says in a kind of rhapsodic passage in a sermon on the Song of Songs. "O love, so precipitate, so violent, so ardent, so impetuous, suffering the mind to entertain no thought but of itself, content with thyself alone, thou disturbest all order, disregardest all usage, ignorest all measure. Thou dost triumph over in thyself and reduce to captivity whatever appears to belong to fittingness, to reason, to decorum, to prudence or counsel." All those good virtues that we're supposed to be practicing in the daily life are sort of transformed and overthrown in the ecstatic union of the soul with God. And the Song of Songs, as you may or may not know, is a very important text, probably the text for the mystical traditions. That's not the only place where it's been important, but it certainly is one. Well, the words that kind of stand out there in that passage from Bernard, for me, are the idea of transcendence, that just as erotic love is an experience of self-transcendence, losing yourself in the other, so Bernard makes an analogy between that and the way the soul is with God at the pinnacle of spiritual experience. Transcendence is one word. The other is that the love of God disturbeth all order. And one of the interesting things about the Song of Songs to me, as well, I don't look like it today, but usually I'm a very organized person. I am Holden after all. I have files, you know, and all sorts of very professional, impressive looking organizational patterns. I never feel like I'm really terribly organized, but everyone thinks that anyway. Keep up the image. So I'm not saying this because I'm a lunatic here, but actually, I think one of the reasons that we need to read this book and think about other dimensions of spirituality is precisely because we become so caught up in our routines of order. Something that, you know, that got to be very important, especially as the Industrial Revolution got going and everything began to get more and more organized and urban society developed and all the things that have happened in the last 250-300 years that have caught us up in patterns of order in our lives that are, in a way, a form of disorder and not being quite human. Schedules, for example. You know, it's a terrible thing to say, well, all right, we'll schedule in time to be with the children. And yet, what married couple with children does not do that? You know? Or even scheduling your lovemaking times. Well, we'll do it at 10. Yeah. People do that. It's kind of crazy, but that's the way that we live now in those routines and those schedules.
Time management.
Well, time management. Yeah, and you know you need it, but on the other hand, what a way to live. You think about that. That everyone is living that way. Phyllis Tribble has written a book that I've recommended. Maybe I can pass it around. You might want to take a look at the table of contents. God and the Rhetoric of Sexuality is a really very good book about a variety of biblical texts. She's a good literary critic. This is no book to browse in. It's very interesting. Or you can just read one chapter at a time, independently of each other. It's a scholarly book, but very readable. And is she at Union Seminary or someplace, Phyllis Tribble? I think, yes, at Union Theological Seminary in New York, professor of sacred literature. She's a Hebrew scholar and a theologian and a feminist and a good literary critic, a dynamite combination, probably the best in her field with this kind of thing. And she has a chapter here called A Love Story Gone Awry, which is an interpretation, to me the most interesting interpretation I've read, of the Genesis creation and fall stories. And then she has another chapter titled Love's Lyrics Redeemed, which is about the Song of Songs. And her argument, they sell this in the bookstore, so if you're going to be around a Monday, I doubt if you're selling it on the sidewalk sale, but it's too valuable a book perhaps for that, but you might. Are you selling it on the sidewalk?
No. You're closed for the day.
Okay. Till Monday, right?
Till Monday.
Yeah. It might be a book you'd want to pick up to have if you own any or would like to own some books of biblical interpretation. Anyway, her argument is that the Song of Songs kind of redeems a love story gone awry because through erotic love as expressed in the Song of Songs, we re-enter the garden. And there are many ways in which the imagery and some of the structures of thought and story in those earlier chapters of Genesis are reversed and replayed and redeemed in the Song of Songs. Well, here, in the Song of Songs, it's especially the order of creation, as we used to call it in the Missouri Synod, that gets turned around. And I wanted to say a few things about that to illustrate the kind of nonsense in the Song of Songs. And I have a few poems to share with you after that that are about various aspects of the even Adam and Eve story. Some of them go pretty far afield. But then I hope we have some time to talk about some other kinds of love poetry that are not so erotic, because most of us probably relate to that kind of poetry better. We were talking about this in the bookstore earlier. Poetry of despair, about lost love and death and love and those kind of those kind of topics. And I've got lots of things here that, and Margaret has a poem that I hope she can read to us about God's love and death. And I have one that is along the same lines of that in Toni Morrison's novel. It's in that same tradition, black sermon rhetoric. We had a nice pile of Bibles and they're gone. So much for planning.
They're right here.
They are. Oh, they're on the other table. Would you mind passing them out? There were more. I don't know where they... We scarfed up all the King James versions of the Bible and put them in here and have been using them because that's the translation that people in literature generally have used in the past and what has influenced them. Not because it's the best translation, but we're not concerned about that in this session so much. One kind of way, and I think it's really interesting that I've lost a piece of paper, hold on. That the Song of Songs upsets the order of creation is to confuse the sex roles of the two people being, who are talking to one another in the book. And one way that happens is that they keep exchanging. You might turn to this book. It is right before Isaiah. It's the book right after Ecclesiastes and Isaiah. That's where it is. One thing they keep doing is exchanging their images for each other. We all did it, right? Litany of liberation from Jack and Jill last night in the Vespers. And use some kind of traditional images of maleness and femaleness. Well, in this poem, a lot of the imagery is drawn from the cults of the Near East, but it's kind of mixed up so that what you might expect to be images for women get also applied to the men and vice versa. And it's one of the kinds of nonsense that you find in here. For instance, in 1:13, the woman is speaking when she says, "A bundle of myrrh is my well-beloved unto me. He shall lie all night betwixt my breasts." Presumably that's at least both a figurative and a literal statement at the same time. People did wear myrrh around their necks as a sort of form of perfume. I suppose that would be rather important in the sweaty, dusty terrain in that part of the world. So he's the myrrh there. Then in 4:6, he's speaking, and he says, "Until the day break and the shadows flee away, I will get me to the mountain of myrrh, to the hill of frankincense." Well, we don't know if he's talking about her literally, if he's talking about a place where he's going to go with her. It's another kind of confusion here. Where are these people, actually? Is this all a landscape of the imagination, or are they really there? But the myrrh is associated with her there rather than with him. What?
Sounds like the tailings to me.
The tailings. They don't smell quite that good. In 4:1, we see that he's speaking when he says to her, "Behold, thou art fair, my love. Behold, thou art fair. Thou hast dove's eyes within thy locks." A lovely image for a woman's eyes. But then we find in 5:12 that his eyes, she says, are as the eyes of doves by the rivers of waters, washed with milk and fitly set. It's almost, by the way, as though these lovers keep exchanging compliments, as though they're sort of outdoing one another with how kind, how gracious, how loving they can be. And then other images, he calls her a garden, she calls him a garden. Now, women are traditionally associated with gardens and their bodies with gardens, but men are not. But in this poem, that happens. In 5:13, she says, "His cheeks are as a bed of spices." Now, that's original. But it's a nice image. "As sweet flowers, his lips like lilies." Probably a lot of American men would not want to have their lips called lilies, you know. But why not? "Dropping sweet-smelling myrrh." And the myrrh then gets transformed and sort of put into other places of the body where it normally is not. Another kind of nonsense. one of the things I noticed when I read this very carefully, and that's one of the things they train you to do at Northwestern, is to just sort of peer at the text hour on end, you know, kind of looking to see what's really there. And then, of course, you've got to stop doing that after a while and look at other things like the historical background of the text and look into yourself and other places. But when you look at this really closely at the syntax of the sentences, you find that there are all kinds of enfoldings of the language. They're like the enfoldings of the lovers in the enfolding of God and the soul in the allegorical interpretation. And one way that happens, which is a kind of nonsense because then you don't know who's speaking exactly, is when she enfolds his speech into her speech. In chapter 2, verse 10, "My beloved spake and said unto me, Rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away." I was reading this last night with a man who was doing the men's parts, which I had underlined in blue, and mine were underlined in pink, so we could tell them apart. And, of course, there are places where I'm saying his lines, and we didn't know how to do it. You know, it was kind of interesting. It's hard sometimes to know who's speaking in this book or how to assign the lines unless you've got a scholarly commentary to give you some idea of how they may have been sung or said in a litany. And she goes on, "The flowers appear on the earth, the time of the singing of birds has come, and the voice of the turtle or the turtle dove is heard in our land." Those are famous lines. They're his lines, but she says them. And so it's as though she appropriates his speech to lure him with his own language. So that sort of erotic confusion enters into the language there. And then there are other times when it's just mutuality of affection that's being stressed. She says in 5:1, or he says rather, "I am come into my garden, my sister, my spouse." You know, he calls her all these different names, all these different parts of the family are included in this very inclusive love poetry. "I have gathered my myrrh with my spice, I have eaten my honeycomb with my honey, I have drunk my wine with my milk." What is he talking about? You know, it's very difficult to tell exactly. It doesn't matter, you don't need to. The point is to be confused, not to be organized, and analyze it and footnote it. "Eat, O friends, drink, yes, drink abundantly, O beloved." And then in 6:3, she says, "I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He feedeth among the lilies." You know, I am his, and he is mine. That kind of exchange of lines is happens throughout this text. So that there are enfoldings of language that confuse, but confuse in order to delight and to show the intimate bonding of these two people, and the ways that they keep changing to one another and yet remain connected. And if the language is kind of phantasmagoric, it just keeps winding back and forth, the images get transferred from one to the other. Not like the usual biblical text, which is more logically organized than that. Anybody want to comment on Song of Songs before we're going to look at some other things? There's one poem I thought we might look at.
I was thinking one
thing. Yeah, go ahead.
After just listening to you yesterday, and love is not linear anyway, and it's not, in a sense, resolved. It is up and down, back and forth, and rules are changed in the dimensions. So it's really a very good portrayal of it. More than here we are trying to figure out where the stages are and the progressions, and it just isn't that way.
Yeah, if you really attend to the rhythms of that relationship, it's probably going to be hard to draw a picture of on the board.
Sure.
You know? I think it's important to remember that and to be reminded of that by reading some of this poetry, for example, because there's an awful lot of planning and analysis that we do of relationships. You know, parental planning, all very important. Planning when we're going to have our kids, when we're going to do this, how we're going to organize this, how these things in our lives are going to work out, you know, my leave of absence and his whatever, you know, that kind of thing. And it's by all means important to do a lot of that in order to accomplish things you want to together. But certainly relationships do not unfold in this logical fashion.
God's relationship doesn't either. In fact, that's the mystery of it, is that you get caught wanting it in a linear stage. Now, where are you spiritually? Well, I'm at stage 3 now. Waiting for the rest of you.
Yeah.
And it just isn't that way.
Yeah. I've avoided reading Gail Sheehy's book passages for years because I don't want to know what passage I'm at, you know. And I'd like to go up onto the mountain like I just didn't get dirty and forget about, you know, what passage that might be back when I was supposed to have back when I was 10. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't think literature charts out particularly well either, especially good stuff, because, I mean, it's some kind of magic and mystical, it can be, and if it really catches your imagination, you can't always make a diagram and a model and draw little things.
Yeah. One of the things I like to do when I teach at Rutgers, I teach big Victorian novels, and you can get very lost in those. And so I'll draw plot lines, and I'll challenge the students to make a picture of this novel. You know, what kind of shape does it have? One person once did a diagram of Jane Eyre that was like a Christmas tree. It was very intricate and really interesting. You know, or you can do plot lines. You can do shadow plot lines that sometimes, you know, emerge and then submerge again in the text. You can do all kinds of fun stuff. But then it's nice to take that structure and just kind of show all the other things going on around it so that it really isn't the whole story.
Yeah, whatever. You can do that, and it's fun and it's interesting, but it never counts for all of it.
No. And of course, that's why you read for that structure partly, but you also read for all the other stuff that's there. And maybe in the end, that's what you really are going for. This poem I thought we might look at is in chapter 7. And we read this last night, but I thought this might be fun to do. Well, there are two poems. This is another way in which these two characters, the woman and the man in here, keep changing roles and are mutual. She has a poem about him in chapter 5, verses 10 to 16. If you want to take your Bible back to your chalet and read it sometime, you're welcome to do that.
They also have Bibles in every room.
Oh, they do?
Without by the American Bible Society.
They do.
Every single room.
Oh, good.
No, they sure skipped
I didn't.
Mine.
They skipped mine, too. Well, maybe
Sorry.
People have, excuse me, taken them, which is probably fine. I don't know about village policy on that. I wouldn't vouch for it. But. Well, I didn't have one in my room. I brought my own. My paperback Bible here is falling apart. There's matching poems. Hers is in chapter 5, verse 10 and on. His is in 7. And these are kind of a kind of love poetry in which one lover observes and describes the other one. You know, descriptive love poetry. And here's his of her. And it's very well organized. As you'll see, it starts with her feet and goes up to her hair. How beautiful are thy feet with shoes, O prince's daughter! The joints of thy thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a cunning workman. Thy navel is like a round goblet, which wanteth not liquor. Thy belly is like an heap of wheat set about with lilies. Thy two breasts are like two young roes that are twins. Thy neck is as a tower of ivory. Thine eyes are the fishpools of Heshbon by the gate of Bathrabim. Thy nose is as a tower of Lebanon which looketh toward Damascus. Thine head upon thee is like Carmel, and the hair of thine head like purple. The king is held in the galleries. Oh, fair, and how pleasant art thou, O love, for delights. These are really extravagant comparisons, aren't they? And this is what I meant by more and too much. It's just one piled on top of another. Robert Alter, in his book, The Art of Biblical Poetry, talks about the way that this poem kind of flaunts the idea of creating figures or metaphors just by, you know, throwing out one after the other, like showing off almost. Who can outdo, which one can outdo the one before? And what's interesting is the way that the whole poem flaunts its playing around with language so much, although the whole of the Song of Songs really does that, and keeps on pushing it farther and farther. I mean, thy nose is like the tower of Lebanon. And then it ends with this wonderful image, which isn't very clear in this translation. The king is held in the galleries, but Alter interprets this, your head on you, like crimson wool, the locks of your head like purple. A king is caught in the flowing tresses. Here the head is described and compared to a tapestry of those beautiful natural dyes. You know, and then the king gets caught up in the tresses, as though the poet gets caught up in the love poetry itself and appears in the poem as the king. And he draws these images from all different areas of life. The feet and the shoes presumably are literal. And then we get into the jewels and the workmen. What areas of life are these images drawn from that you see in ancient world terms? This person is drawing upon.
Architecture.
Uh-huh. What else is here?
The high state of the economy under Solomon.
Right. This kind of richness that, you know, associates this book with Solomon, of course. And all his jewels and gold and whatnot. The artisans of jewelry makers and metallurgists and agriculture, the heap of wheat set about with lilies. There are fertility images in here. There are images from the animal world, the rose, and then the civic monuments, the architecture, tapestries, you know, textiles, weaving. So that the whole thing is kind of inclusive of every aspect of artisanry or craftsmanship in the ancient world he associates with her. Starting then with kind of a celebration of artifice, thy thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a cunning workman. He then goes on to make a poem that is a cunning work of art, entering into the artistic beauty of his beloved. And the images are very, in very strange, nonsensical way, very explicit sexually, but also very indirect at the same time. I don't know how you do that, but Song of Songs is always doing that. It's not erotic in the sense that it's like The Joy of Sex, a book, also another book I never read, never got past the title.
You read the pictures.
That I didn't even look at the pictures. No. Why do lovers speak poetry to one another, do you think? Why is love and poetry associated, I suppose?
Well, there's one theory that in an earlier period in human life, what today we would call rhyme and verse were more common form of speech.
Uh-huh.
So the primitive speaking would have been associated with what is both primitive and advanced behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether that's true or not, but that's what I think.
Primitive in quotes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think in terms of language and poetry, you can violate. You're not bound so much.
Mm-hmm.
You're not bound to explain yourself. You just mm-hmm. set the images out. If you try to write poetry, You don't feel that you have to do it in a rational way. The image is valid if it means something to you, so you put it down. So that's how love would be, that you can't.
The idea of violation, which sounds violent to us, and that's the way we generally use the word. It was one of the words behind the litany. I don't think it got into the litany, but it was implied. Is a negative sense, but certainly the violation of boundaries between individual personalities is broken down in love making, and also in poetry. The ordinary boundaries that you put around experiences and name this and name that. Well, Shakespeare says that the poet gives embodiment to things that his imagination comes with and gives them a local habitation and a name. This, 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 which before weren't there. So boundaries are fluid in poetry. And that's one reason you read it, to break out of some of your boundaries. That's not the only reason you read it, by any means. But that's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Another is to give order to your experience. But it may be a new order or a fresh way of ordering that experience. Because we can't live without order. Our minds need it. But we get stuck in patterns of order that become meaningless. Yes, Mom?
With the patterns of order, I think sometimes language is so limiting. And by using poetry, we get away from some of those limits because we start maybe speaking in more imagery or metaphorical kinds of text. And that's a little bit closer to getting away from the limits of feelings. Like, feelings of love can't really be explained. So we try and put it in language that you really can't say, and it kind of goes all together.
People get very trapped in their language, especially as they grow older. I find this to be true with the academics I work with. No matter what they're talking about, they always sound like a history professor, or an economics professor, or a marketing management professor, whatever. You know, I hate to spend certain kinds of time with those people.
Well, what happens is that they tend to refine what they're doing to a point that it becomes something they say, now that's it. And then you see that's it several times over and over again.
That's why the more is needed. There's more beyond your language, your boundaries. Language does entrap us, you know, as well as liberate us in making us not, once we've got a name for something, we think we understand it. And that we've set out the boundaries of knowledge or whatever, and that can be very limiting, yeah.
I think there are a couple other possibilities. As if the love is genuine in a sense, more emotional rather than thought out, often there's a good amount of trust. Mm-hmm. And the basic trust makes it possible for you to say things or try to say things which ordinarily you'd be reluctant to say because you'd be afraid of seeming foolish or strange or ridiculous. But in a love situation, even if it's not erotic love, in various situations where you feel comfortable, even with a therapist, for example, you will try to say things which normally you wouldn't try to say because you know the person wouldn't be open to listening to what you say. So I think that's one part. Another part is the relationship, I think, between poetry and singing and music, the same kind of question you could ask about why, at least in some cultures, do you use music so often to celebrate love, but and other things too. And that's, you know, the nature of singing or vocalizing in music too almost presumes, on the one hand, lots of rules for certain kinds, but on the other hand, we know that you break the rules, that the really creative ones are the ones who somehow disregard the rules or manipulate the rules in their own special way. I think those are other reasons why often we end up paying attention to other people's love poetry and maybe in some way using it ourselves, that we might not presume outside of a situation to put it on paper or to recite it for somebody.
Certainly those poems are ways to have vicarious experiences. I came up with this idea of doing some love poetry up here, and I wanted to do a whole lot more than I'm going to be able to because I'm leaving tomorrow. I came up with it at the end of a relationship with someone, and I don't know if what it seemed like a lunatic idea to even meditate on love at all. It'd be better to meditate on something else like electricity or, you know, something totally unrelated. But I think maybe that's perhaps was one of my agenda items in my own head or heart, was to experience some things vicariously or in memory of or whatever, when I wasn't having them in real life. And that's one thing you can read love poetry for.
Poetry wouldn't.
Yeah, go ahead.
Poetry really wouldn't be for the mentally lazy, would it?
Well, I don't. It depends on what kind of poetry it is. The kind of poetry I like is not for the mentally lazy, but you know, I'm trained to do that. I mean, it's my business to like that hard stuff.
But there's a kind of, I mean, all of us could be taken right back to a certain time and place by the worst pop song you can imagine.
That's true.
You know, the poetry of pop music, yeah. Which, you know, to analyze something else, but it doesn't have to be terribly intellectual stuff to trigger all the triggers to get us where we were.
No, it doesn't have to be intellectual. Mm-hmm. But if you don't want to move anywhere, if you don't want to be transformed a bit, you know, then I guess it wouldn't affect you, or you wouldn't want to read it.
So that's one purpose of poetry would be to allow the reader to interpolate.
Sure, get your mind going.
Would that be mm-hmm. one?
To sort of set your imagination going, so it has to make some new connections. So that, you know, and the Song of Songs is a prime example of that, because there's so many holes and gaps in this text that you have to fill in the gaps if you're going to try to understand it. You know, your imagination has to enter in to read this, or else you don't know what the world is talking about.
In teaching poetry, would you teach aspiring poets if that's one of the purposes, that you allow the reader to interpolate?
Sure.
Is that,
yeah. That's is how you get your mental exercise, to some extent, is it's from taking off from something else somebody else started. And certainly a poem is not the same as an analysis, which might lay out, you know, all the main points.
Well, I shared with Janet that that's how I taught reading last year, was poetry, mm-hmm. to my fourth and fifth graders.
Mm-hmm. Makes you pay attention to words.
Made them focus, mm-hmm. but then it also allowed them to take off.
Yeah, right. So that you get discipline and freedom in that kind of reading exercise. There's a favorite verse here I want to read to you. It's very short, in chapter 8. To find it first. In that verse 6, set me as a seal upon thine heart, as a seal upon thine arm, for love is strong as death. Love is strong as death. That phrase can have all kinds of various meanings. It can be a very ominous sort of meaning. It can be a very reassuring one. It doesn't say that love is stronger than death. That's an idea we might get elsewhere in the Bible, but not right here. And I was thinking that, Margaret, maybe you would like to read this poem. Do you feel like doing it?
Okay. Did
I brought it.
Okay.
Because there are, I had some other songs about love and death to read. We have about 10 more minutes.
Okay.
And maybe we could look at a couple of those too. Because one of the things about love is it gets mixed up with all kinds of other intense experiences like grief, confusion, mourning, ecstasy. And this poem, wonderful picture in this, well illustrated, passes around. This poem is called Go Down Death, and maybe you could say something about who wrote it.
Okay. It's by James Walden Johnson, and I was at one of Jan's earlier readings, and we were just talking about the oral tradition. And this is one that I hope you remember. And it's a funeral song. discernment is what it is. And so it would be told by a black minister. And I've heard it recited on record. And it's it almost becomes a song. It's like a liturgy. I will just read the words and let you add that as part of your imagination. You can imagine this black minister up there and the people in the congregation probably crying and weeping and wailing along with it. I'll just give you the words though. Weep not, she is not dead. She's resting in the bosom of Jesus. Heartbroken husband, weep no more. Grief-stricken son, weep no more. Left lonesome daughter, weep no more. She's only just gone home. Day before yesterday morning, God was looking down from his great high heaven, looking down on all his children. And his eye fell on Sister Caroline, tossing on her bed of pain. And God's big heart was touched with pity, with the everlasting pity. And God sat back on his throne, and he commanded that tall, bright angel standing at his right hand, call me Deb. And that tall, bright angel cried in a voice that broke like a clap of thunder, call Deb, call Deb. And the echo sounded down the streets of heaven till it reached away back to that shadowy place where death waits with his pale white horses. And death heard the summons. And he leaped on his fastest horse, pale as a sheep in the moonlight. Up the golden street death galloped, and the hoofs of his horse struck fire from the gold. But they didn't make no sound. Up death rode to the great white throne and waited for God's command. And God said, go down, death, go down. Go down to Savannah, Georgia, down in Yamacraw, and find Sister Caroline. She's borne the burden and heat of the day. She's labored long in my vineyard, and she's tired. She's weary. Go down, death, and bring her to me. And death didn't say a word, but he loosed the reins on his pale white horse. And he clamped the spurs to his bloodless sides. And out and down he rode, through heaven's pearly gates, past suns and moons and stars. On death rode, and the foam from his horse was like a comet in the sky. On death rode. Leaving the lightning's flash behind, straight on down he came. While we were watching round her bed, she turned her eyes and looked away. She saw what we couldn't see. She saw old death. She saw old death coming like a falling star. Death didn't frighten Sister Caroline. He looked at her like a welcome friend. And she whispered to us, I'm going home. And she smiled and closed her eyes. And death took her up like a baby. And she lay in his icy arms. But she didn't feel no chill. And death began to ride again. Up beyond the evening star, out beyond the morning star, into the glittering light of glory, onto the great white throne. There he laid Sister Caroline on the loving breast of Jesus. And Jesus took his own hand and wiped away her tears. And he smoothed the furrows from her face. And the angel sang a little song. And Jesus wrapped her in his arms and kept saying, take your rest, take your rest, take your rest. Weep not, she is not dead. She's resting in the bosom of Jesus.
Well, that just rocks you right in.
That's on the record, isn't it?
And on the record, then there's a, it's almost in song, it's called Golden.
Who sings that? Do you know, or how, where that record? I'd love to get that.
I had it in my classroom. I don't know where.
I think it's old because I've heard that.
Does what, Johnson himself read it?
But the record I have is a reading of, you know, it's a record of poetry readings.
I would like to recommend a novel to you if you want to. I mean, they may even have. Do you have this in the bookstore?
Yeah, we do. After you asked about it, I followed
this. Song of Solomon by Toni Morrison, about all kinds of love. And there's a lot of other biblical references in here, too. There's a character named Hagar. In this chapter 13, Hagar dies. I think it's interesting, this is chapter 13, because this is where some of the love sermons all pile up in the book. You know, 1 Corinthians 13. I don't know if she intended that. I always wanted to ask her that. But there's a sermon on love by a character named Guitar. It's all about black people in the North. And he talks about love to Hagar, and Hagar's love, sort of moonstruck, kind of lunatic lover. Ditched by another character named Milkman, who's the hero of the book. Milkman's another kind of lover, sort of in love with his mother. And Hagar goes to the store. She wants to get Milkman's love back. She goes to the store and she finds, reads all the labels. And there's this whole sort of almost litany about the labels. The air du temps and the d'Orsay intoxication and all the different names of the perfumes, that she's going to buy love. And she buys all these things to try to get his love back. And she's going kind of crazy and she's kind of sick and she's going home and gets caught in the rain, and the rain breaks her shopping bag and these cosmetics kind of go all over and float on down the street. It's terribly sad. And she's talking to her mother. She gets home and she's saying he doesn't like my hair because I've got this woolly hair and he likes silky hair, and it goes on like that. Well, she dies after this sort of last attempt to become beautiful, become a desirable woman. And it doesn't quite say what she dies of. It's sort of like a Victorian novel in that respect. The heroine just kind of collapses, but it's almost as though she dies of indifference of other people. And I thought I might read this bit from the funeral. It's not too long. It's a little bit like what you were doing. It's written by a woman, so maybe it's in a novel situation. And I'm not going to explain it much. I think you can probably figure out how it fits in. A female quartet from Linden Baptist Church had already sung Abide With Me. The wife of the mortician had read the condolence cards, and the minister had launched into his, quote, naked came ye into this life, and naked shall ye depart sermon, which he had always believed suitable for the death of a young woman. And the winos in the vestibule who came to pay their respects to Pilate's girl. Pilate is the grandmother who comes in later to sing. It's her granddaughter who's died, but who dared not enter, had begun to sob. So we got the winos out in the vestibule. When the door swung open and Pilate burst in, shouting, "Mercy!" as though it were a command. A young man stood up and moved toward her. She flung out her right arm and almost knocked him down. "I want mercy," she shouted, and began walking toward the coffin, shaking her head from side to side as though somebody had asked her a question, and her answer was no. And halfway up the aisle, she stopped, lifted a finger, and pointed. Then slowly, although her breathing was fast and shallow,
She lowered her hand to her side. It was strange, that languorous, limp hand coming to rest at her side while her breathing was coming so quick and fast. "Mercy," she said again, but she whispered it now. The mortician scurried toward her and touched her elbow. She moved away from him and went right up to the bier. She tilted her head and looked down. Her earring grazed her shoulder. Out of the total blackness of her clothes, it blazed like a star. She's got her name in this one earring she wears. A little piece of paper in there. Her name, Pilot. The mortician tried to approach her again and move closer, but when he saw her inky, berry black lips, her cloudy, rainy eyes, the wonderful brass box hanging from her ear, he stepped back and looked at the floor. "Mercy?" She was now asking a question. "Mercy?" It was not enough. The word needed a bottom, a frame. She straightened up, held her head high, and transformed the plea into a note. In a clear bluebell voice, she sang it out. The one word held so long, it became a sentence. And before the last syllable had died in the corners of the room, she was answered in a sweet soprano, "I hear you." The people turned around. Reba, who's her daughter, and Hagar's mother, had entered and was singing too. Pilot neither acknowledged her entrance nor missed a beat. She simply repeated the word mercy, and Reba replied. The daughter standing in the back of the chapel, the mother up front, they sang. In the nighttime, mercy. In the darkness, mercy. In the morning, mercy. At my bedside, mercy. On my knees now, mercy, 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 mercy. They stopped at the same time in a high silence. Pilate reached out her hand and placed three fingers on the edge of the coffin. Now she addressed her words to the woman bordered in gray satin who lay before her. Softly, privately, she sang to Hagar the very same reassurance she had promised her when she was a little girl. She sings this, but I'm not going to try. "Who's been bothering my sweet sugar lumpkin? Who's been bothering my baby? Who's been bothering my sweet sugar lumpkin? Who's been bothering my baby girl? Somebody's been bothering my sweet sugar lumpkin. Somebody's been bothering my baby. Somebody's been bothering my sweet sugar lumpkin. Somebody's been bothering my baby girl. I'll find who's bothering my sweet sugar lumpkin. I'll find who's bothering my baby. I'll find who's bothering my sweet sugar lumpkin. I'll find who's bothering my baby girl. My baby girl." The three words were still pumping in her throat as she turned away from the coffin. Looking about at the faces of the people seated in the pews, she fastened on the first pair of eyes that were directed toward her. She nodded at the face and said, "My baby girl." She looked for another pair of eyes, told him also, "My baby girl." Moving back down the aisle, she told each face, turned toward her, the same piece of news, "My baby girl, my baby girl, my baby girl. My sweet baby girl." Conversationally, she spoke, identifying Hagar, selecting her away from everybody else in the world who had died. First she spoke to the ones who had the courage to look at her, shake their heads, say amen. Then she spoke to those whose nerve failed them, whose glance would climb no higher than the long black fingers at her side. Toward them especially, she leaned a little, telling in three words the full story of the stumped life in the coffin behind her. "My baby girl." Words tossed like stones into a silent cannon. Suddenly, like an elephant who just found his anger and lifts his trunk over the heads of the little men who want his teeth or hide or his flesh or his amazing strength, pilot trumpeted for the sky itself to hear, and she was loved. It startled one of the sympathetic winos in the vestibule, and he dropped his bottle, spurting emerald glass and jungle red wine everywhere. Toni Morrison.
Thanks for coming. Paul, I've got a poem to share with you before you go away. You want to see it?
I'm just going to cross the second setting.
What?
Yeah, I'll look at it. That makes me
feel. Are you going up to
I'm
eat?
I'm going to eat.
Well, don't stop and eat. I'll find it.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I'm just going to leave all this stuff here. How's that? Mm-hmm.